Saving Thousands is brought to you in part by RP Funding. RP Funding, Inc. is licensed and can offer loans in Alabama, Arkansas, Florida, Kentucky, Louisiana, North Carolina, Ohio, Oklahoma, South Carolina, Tennessee, Texas, Virginia, and West Virginia, and is also licensed by the Mississippi Department of Banking and Consumer Finance and by the Pennsylvania Department of Banking and Securities. Office is located at 500 Winterly Place, Suite 300, Maitland, Florida, 32751. Telephone 321-397-4420. RP Funding's nationwide mortgage licensing system ID number is 70168, Equal Housing Opportunity, and Robert Palmer's NMLS ID number is 76197.
We are saving thousands with Robert Palmer right here on the Saving Thousands Radio Network. Robert Palmer, the founder of RP Funding, is an author, a widely known radio and television personality, public speaker, dedicated to help you and me and everyone take charge of our finances. Now, in the next hour, you'll find yourself with a much better grasp of your finances, of your money. And you'll find yourself with more money in your wallet, your pocketbook at the end of the day, end of the week, end of the month. That's the goal, and we're going to get you there. Now, Robert, when we were discussing important segments for the Saving Thousands radio show today, I know you got really worked up and motivated when it came to the topic of debit cards. Now, you're not a fan, and for good reason.
Maybe we'll make this debit cards are dangerous. Maybe we'll make that rule number 10. So I'm not gonna tell you not to use a debit card. I will tell you that I personally do not carry a debit card. I went through a lot of hoops with my bank to get them to issue me a good old-fashioned ATM card that cannot be used as a check card. It only is an ATM card, only with the PIN number. And the reason is if someone steals that credit debit card thing, they can run it without the PIN number, and the money comes out of your checking account instantly. And the fraud protections aren't the same. Right now, some banks will offer the fraud protections for extra money, but as far as the federal laws go, on a credit card, your maximum liability is $50, all right, no matter when you report it. On a debit card, it's $50 if you report it in the first 48 hours, and then it jumps up to $500, and then after that, I think after 60 days, it goes to there is no protection. But the bigger problem is when somebody steals your debit card and that money is now out of your account, what's going to happen? You know, my now wife, on one of our first dates, her purse was stolen. I didn't steal it, you know, thank God. No, somebody stole her purse. And, they went and within like 30 minutes, they had run this thing up at every gas station in Central Florida. Because trust me, they have a plan. Like nobody just like, oh, there's a purse. Let me grab it. Like they've got a plan in place. Like we're going to snatch this purse and we're going to hit these 27 gas stations that don't ask for the zip code. Or we're going to look and see what the zip code is on our driver's license because we have that too. And so we're going to type that zip code in on the debit card. See, that's the thing. A lot of people think, oh, well, the gas stations, they want your credit card zip code now. Well, how many of you have that on your driver's license?
Yeah.
Your ATM PIN number is not on your driver's license, I hope. If your ATM PIN number is written on your driver's license, please do something about that. But yeah, so they have your zip code right there on your driver's license and they got your debit card and they will now go systematically drain your bank account. And in her case, her rent check bounced because of this. Because, you know, she had enough money for her rent, but when they cleaned her out at $2,000 or $3,000 in the course of 2 hours, and now her rent check bounced. What are you going to do now? You know, your landlord, you're trying to tell them the story. They just think you're a deadbeat. Yeah, they don't want to hear it.
Sure.
And you're fighting with the bank to try to get the money put back. It takes about 10 days at minimum to get that money put back in your account.
And how many $35 charges are you racking up on bounced checks?
Killing you with the overdraft fees. Where if that same scenario had happened and she had not had a debit card, if she only had credit cards, they could have stolen the same $3,000 on the credit card. But the difference is her money was not would not have been in jeopardy. Her rent check would not have bounced. There would have been no overdraft fees. You don't have to wait 10 days to get the money put back. You know, you don't owe the credit card payment for about 40 days usually from the charge, depending on when your statement drops and the grace period. So that's plenty of time for you to work this out with the credit card company, where with that debit card, the money is gone. And you may not be able to eat, right? I mean, you're calling your parents like, hey, mom, I need to borrow $20 to eat because some idiot stole my check card or debit card and cleaned me out. And the bank's not going to give me my money back for 10 days. And I can't eat. And I need to eat. So can I come over for dinner, mom? Mm-hmm. And she's like, come on over, son. You're always welcome home for dinner. Right. I schlep on over to Lakeland and have a free dinner with mom. But this is so debit cards are dangerous. I personally am not a big fan of the debit cards. I do not carry a debit card. I have a good old fashioned ATM automated teller machine card. It cannot be swiped and signed. It has to be PIN numbered. It's got to have my PIN number in there. Right. And it's tough to get those because the banks make more money on the debit card. They like the swiping.
Yeah, they get, you know, they get what, 1%, 2% for every transaction?
Yeah, they get these interchange fees. There's all these, it's complicated for them, but they get all these fees and swipe charges, and it's one amount if they swipe another amount for the PIN number and whatever. The other key is you don't, you know, the money goes out immediately.
Oh, right then.
So when you use a credit card, the money doesn't actually, you don't have to actually pay that for like 40 or 50 days, which means there, if you are smart, there's ways you can maximize that float on that money by paying less interest or earning interest in an investment. With a debit card, you don't get that. It just comes right out. So rule number 10, we're going to call it debit cards are dangerous. And so, I think this goes back to don't be afraid of credit. There's absolutely nothing wrong. I think everyone out there listening should have a credit card. There is no reason to not have a credit card. And now don't go crazy and abuse it, and don't think this is free money and you can go run the thing up and whatever, you know. No, it's got to be treated with respect. You know, you've got to use it wisely, but you got to have one. I mean, I think it's much smarter to carry a credit card and pay it off every month than it is to use a debit card or a check card, where you're giving the world direct access to your bank account, which can destroy other parts of your finances.
So use the Saving Thousands rule number 6 and spread your newfound knowledge about the dangers of those debit cards. And ask your bank for an old-fashioned ATM card for withdrawing cash when you need it. And of course, that card requires a PIN number at the terminal, so it's much more secure. And as Robert said, use rule number 4. Don't abuse credit, but don't fear it either. Get yourself a credit card or two for reward purchases, but make sure that you make the payments on time. And again, the Saving Thousands rules to success can be found at savingthousands.com. Okay, Robert, we've got a question for you. How long does negative information like late payments and all that, how long will you be left on the credit report?
And so what will happen is if it just happened, right? So if you got a collection yesterday, they've got the records right there. They're hot and ready. And, you know, but if you catch them 3, 4, 5 years from now, and maybe they've upgraded their computer software and not all the data carried over, maybe they transferred that from one company to a different company and some records got lost in the mix, things happen. That companies are not perfect. And so when they lose part of the data, right? So maybe they can see you had an account, but the software no longer tells them what the balance is or what the payment is. Because you got to think, this works particularly well with like charge-offs or old closed accounts, right? Because as long as you owe them money, they will keep good records, right? So if you owe if you owe me money, then you're going to stay kind of at the top of the list. Now, once you have paid me off as a creditor, your importance diminishes. And when I'm looking at how many gigabytes and terabytes of data I have, and it's time to archive and flush and upgrade and whatever they do, the people who don't owe me money anymore, I don't really care, right? Right. And so the idea is if you paid a collection off a couple years ago and you dispute it today, they may just not have the data anymore.
Right.
Because they got paid. They're done. It's over. Now, they're going to keep it for a little while. You can't pay it off and dispute it a week later and think it's going to fall off. I mean, it would take a pretty inept company to lose the data that quickly. But as time goes on, and so this is where some of these companies have had success. They will dispute everything on your credit, right, which I am not advocating. All right, don't just dispute everything on your credit. Use some rhyme and reason to it. Like, look at when it was, what it is, whatever. But these companies will just dispute everything on your credit, which you can do all by yourself. And then they will get lucky, because that's all you're doing is you're getting lucky. And some of the companies will lose the data, fail to respond on time. Right? Because again, if you owe me money and I see you're disputing it on the credit, I'm thinking, oh, well, maybe they're trying to buy a house. Maybe they're trying to buy a car. Let me get the collection bulldog back after them and see if I can get my money. If you've already paid me, I don't care. So what motivation does this credit collection company have to respond to the credit bureaus? Now, if they never respond, they'll get in trouble. You know, Equifax, TransUnion, Experian expect them to maintain a certain level of integrity with their reporting and not just lose every battle on purpose. But if you catch them right and you don't owe them any money, there's a good chance they'll delete it. Now, if you owe them money, they will produce the records. They will go to great lengths because they want their money. And they know the best chance they have of getting their money is staying on your credit report.
right? Once they're paid, their motivation is gone. You now as a consumer have a better chance of this company failing to respond, failing to have kept the records, and this is where the dispute process can work. So in today's world, there are two ways you can dispute. You can use the old-fashioned mail method and support the United States Postal Service. Everybody knows they need all the help they can get.
They do, yeah.
You know, I support them. I send a ton of direct mail. But the internet's killing them. Anyway, so or you can dispute it online. So like at myfico.com, when I pulled that $60 credit report yesterday to go over with everybody online, at the bottom of each bureau was a button that said start dispute. And in some cases, you can, so I guess let's roll back to another thing. You can get a free credit report, a real one, not the guy singing the song where you have to sign up for 12 months of advantage, whatever, blah, blah, blah. But you can get a real free credit report if you have, in most states, if you have been denied for credit. So the idea is if I call and try to get a mortgage or I try to get a credit card or whatever and I get denied, I should then get to know why I was denied and what's on my credit report. And so if the U.S. government said everybody gets free credit reports all the time, people would abuse it. So what they said is if you are denied for credit, then you can go get a free credit report to find out what's in your file. So if you've recently been denied for credit, you can go on to each of the three bureaus and apply to get your free credit report, and then you can use that to start the dispute process completely free online. Now, that you have to do at Equifax, TransUnion, and Experian. I always found it was easier just to pay the $60 or the $30 or whatever it is. But anyway, but you can do the free route as well. And so now as we talk about disputes, right, we're talking about the type. And so I'm actually going to try this, Rob.
Oh.
So I'm going to run an experiment.
Oh, boy. Here
so
we go.
I have a 30-day late on my credit report from Discover. All right. This happened like 5 or 6 years ago. And it wasn't because I didn't have the money. It was like a $3. So what happened is I paid the card in full, but I missed it by a couple, whatever happened.
Yeah.
And so there was like a couple bucks in interest that went on there. And then I didn't use the card. And so I didn't think to go back on and check for another payment. And so I owed like a $3 minimum payment on a $3 balance. And I missed it because I don't check my mail very regularly. This was in the early days of starting the mortgage company,
sure.
And I was distracted. So I have this 30-day late on my credit. This was like 5 years ago, 5, 6 years ago. So what I did is, and this is what I recommend anyone do, if you do accidentally get a 30-day late, immediately pay the card in full and close it, cancel it, be done with it.
Right?
Because we want to get out of their system as quickly as possible.
Keeping on top of our credit standing is something most of us just don't do. Let's admit it. You know, what usually happens is this. We fall in love with the car, we fall in love with a boat, or bigger yet, we fall in love with a house and we really want it, but we get denied. Now that comes as a total surprise. If we had taken time on a regular basis to check on our credit reports, we could have been proactive and improved the situation so no bad surprises. Now that makes for a confident consumer. This all ties in directly with the Saving Thousands rule number 11. Don't gamble with the essentials. You know, retirement accounts, savings accounts, interest rate locks. These essentials should be safeguarded so you don't get taken. Again, your copy of the Saving Thousands rules is at savingthousands.com. That's savingthousands.com. Now, another essential part of buying a home is the appraisal. Robert, what in the world is the appraisal?
One of the things we do at RP Funding is we don't use what's called an appraisal management company. We work directly with the appraisers. Mm-hmm. So some companies out there, because they're mortgage brokers or because of the way they're structured, they cannot work directly with the appraiser. They have to go through a middleman, an appraisal management company. What we find is this raises costs to consumers and lowers quality of the report because an appraisal management company will bid that report out and say, who will do it for the cheapest? So they're going to charge the customer way up here and then go try to find an appraiser who will do it for way cheaper and then they get to pocket the difference. That's their business model. So if all of a sudden there's an appraiser 200 miles away who's down on his luck and really needs to work that day, he'll bid super low and come do that appraisal when he doesn't really understand the area.
Mm-hmm.
So we work directly with our appraisers. We've got great relationships. Most of the appraisers we work with, we're their largest client because we go directly to them and we use them over and over again.
Oh, yeah.
So we've got a great relationship, so we get faster service and I believe a higher quality of work from those appraisers. So the appraiser's job is to go out there and give us the value of the home. Now, a lot of people get concerned, oh, if I got to clean up the house, I need to make the house look as good as possible. I mean, I think it's nice if the appraiser doesn't walk into a disaster, but cleaning a house is not going to affect its value.
Okay, the appraiser is there to look at square footage, mm-hmm. bedrooms and bathrooms, overall quality of construction and quality of amenities. You know, if one house has linoleum flooring throughout, another has very nice hardwood floors and tiles, that will make an impact. Corian countertops versus Formica. It's not a dollar-for-dollar impact, but it will cause them to compare you to other similar houses. So if half the houses in your neighborhood are really nice countertops and really nice cabinets and flooring, and half are not so nice, yours will be compared to whichever set you're closest to.
Mm-hmm.
So what they do is the appraiser comes out and he looks at the house. He'll measure the rooms. He'll verify the square footage. He'll look for very, very glaring defects. Hole in the roof, broken windows, missing kitchen, missing toilets. He's not a home inspector. He's not there to give you that checklist long-term inspection. He's just there to make sure as a lender, we're not getting into something we don't want to get involved in because sure. the home is really damaged. So what he does is he figures out your square footage and your bedrooms and your bathrooms and your basic overall quality, and then he goes to look for other homes that have sold recently nearby that are similar. Right. So if you've got a three-bedroom, two-bath, and it's 2,000 square feet, he's going to say, okay, well, what did the last three-bedroom, two-bath house that was 2,000 square feet sell for? Okay, well, that's a pretty good indication of what your house is worth. Now, let's say that he finds a house that's only 1,800 square feet. He has to adjust that value upward to what it would have sold for had it had the extra 200 square foot. Okay, this is how mm-hmm. the appraisal works. And so as a customer, you're entitled to a copy of this appraisal report. We provide it to everyone. As soon as we receive it, we turn around and we provide it to the client so you can review it and you can see it. Once upon a time, lenders tried to hide the appraisal from the customer. It was the craziest thing ever. Wow. So there, we do have to provide that to you, and we provide it to you as soon as we get it because I encourage our customers to read through it, take a look at it, see what other homes sold for. And so what happens sometimes is the appraisal will come in low. All right. So you're trying to buy mm-hmm. the house for $220,000 and the appraisal comes in at $210,000. And sometimes customers will get upset about this. Well, the appraisal came in low. You're going to keep me from getting my house. Well, I ask you, do you want to pay $210,000? You pay $220,000 for a house only worth $210,000.
Yeah.
You
know?
Well, there's another lender who tells me they've got an appraiser who can get it to appraise for $220,000. Okay, but is that really what's in your best interest as a buyer? Do you mm-hmm. really want to overpay for this house? This is such a huge financial situation. Do you want to walk in $10,000 upside down from day one because you tried to find a crooked appraiser who would jack it up and give you the value you wanted versus the value that was justified? And in fact, Fannie Mae has just rolled out a new tool to prevent this from happening, where they're actually going to run an automated check on all the appraisals up front before closing.
Very good.
So a lot of this bad behavior is going to go away. But as a customer, why would you want to pay more than what a house is worth? You shouldn't.
Yeah.
So if the appraisal comes in for less than what you're trying to pay for the house, look at that as a good thing. That's saving you from having to buy the house for more than what it's worth, right?
That's
I mean,
right.
Come on. So the appraiser's job is to go out there and figure all this out and make sure that the home is worth what you're paying, because the worst thing we can do for a consumer and for a home buyer is put them in a house that's already upside down, right? Yeah. So the appraiser has a very important job. Now, the thing people get confused about is the tax assessor's value, right? So just because the appraiser goes out there and tells us the house is worth $300,000, does not now mean that the county tax assessor is going to raise his value up to $300,000. Thank goodness, because all of our yeah. property tax bills would be considerably higher. What we see on average is the county assessed value is around 75% of the value that an appraiser would give it, which is helpful because that means you're going to pay less property taxes. But a lot of people, when they go to refinance their house or they go to sell their house, they take a look at this and say, oh, well, the county says my house is only worth $200,000. And I owe $220,000. I'm upside down. You're not upside down. That county assessed value is always going to be about 25% less than what a licensed real estate appraiser would give value to for that house.
That makes it a lot simpler. But there's always confusion. People will always say appraisal, assessed value, they don't match. How can that possibly be? And they don't realize one's based on taxes. Another is based on comparables around the neighborhood.
That's it. So the three big takeaways are you've got your home inspector. This is who works for you, who goes out to make sure the mechanical and structural effects of the house are in working order and are good. Then you have the home appraiser, whose job is to go out there and make sure that the home's value is accurate and that you're not overpaying for that home. And he'll look for some major defects, but mainly he's there more looking at value. And then finally, you've got the tax assessor, which is the county telling you what they think the home is worth in order to tax it and to give you a tax bill every year.
The appraisal process being misused was another cause of the meltdown back in 2006, 7, and 8. See, people would want a house so badly, and the prices were so out of line, and anybody could get a loan,
that they would ask the appraiser, they'd actually bribe the appraiser to come up with the value so they could get a mortgage. Now, the good news is those days are behind us. The appraised value is going to be the market value based on the facts. Now, Robert, most people, most of us out here, we only apply for one or two mortgages in their lives. So there's a lot about this process we don't understand. And one of the things that I know comes up time and time again is people always ask, why am I being called and getting letters asking for more and more information?
We're required by government regulations to gather documents to the lowest common denominator. And there are people out there who try to commit fraud, right? So if you give me a bank statement with no name and no account number and no bank name on it, I'm not saying you're trying to commit fraud, but that could be. You could have accidentally given me your wife's bank statement or your cousin's bank statement or your nephew's bank statement. I don't know. Your name's not on it. And I don't know which bank it came from. And so this now causes us to go back to you and say, sir, I need another bank statement. Now, we've worked really hard with our staff to do a better job and always do a better job of explaining why. Because a lot of mortgage companies don't.
Right.
They say, oh, I need your bank statement. I gave you my bank statement. I need your bank statement. Well, I need your new bank statement because your last bank statement was missing this and this and this. And here's why it didn't meet our guidelines. And so this can lead to that feeling. The other thing is documents can expire, right? So when we start the pre-qualification process, you give me a pay stub today. Well, then we get down to the closing table 4 months later. I need an updated pay stub from you. Well, I already gave you my pay stub. Well, something may have changed. Your hours may have gotten cut. You may have gotten a raise. These things happen. So we have to keep updated documentation. Maybe you applied for your loan in December 2014, and now we're closing on your loan in March 2015. Well, guess what? You have since received your 2014 W-2. I couldn't ask you for it December of 14. It didn't exist yet. But now because time has gone on, we're later in the process when you're ready to actually buy a house. Now your 2015 W-2 is available. Now I need it. So this all plays into the documentation process. And this is why it's so difficult, because there is no standard set. Timing makes a difference. The information makes a difference. Let's say during the process, you find out that you have a child out there you didn't know about. And now you have to start paying child support. When you applied for the loan, you didn't know about it. It wasn't on your pay stubs. Now you give me an updated pay stub, and it shows a child support deduction. Now I'm going to have to ask you for more documentation. I'm now going to need documentation on how much child support you pay and who you pay it to and for how long you'll have to pay it. You know, all these things can be triggered by another piece of documentation we get. So it's important to understand we're not losing your documentation. We're not just trying to frustrate you by asking for more and more and more documentation. Something we've gotten has triggered the need for something new, or something we've gotten does not meet the standards we need in that your name is missing, the bank name is missing, maybe your employer's name is missing, maybe it's not legible. And then the other situation you run into, Rob, is so maybe you give us your tax returns, and then we try to verify that those tax returns are accurate with the IRS. Huge problem we had in 2006 and 7, 4 and 5 is that people were doctoring up tax returns.
Yes, indeed.
It's very easy to do. You go down and buy yourself a copy of TurboTax, and you can give me a tax return that says anything you want it to, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's just a piece of software. You can go into TurboTax and put that you are Dr. Rob Newton and you made $22 million last year.
Sure.
And you can hand me a well-printed 1040 that looks like it's legitimate. So we have to verify the authenticity of the tax returns with the IRS. Well, if you just filed, it may not be in the IRS system yet. So you give me a tax return. I think everything's okay. Then the IRS comes back and says, no record found. We don't have that tax return. Now, I'm not going to automatically assume that you're giving me a fake tax return. I'm going to assume that the IRS has not had a time to process it. So there's two things we can do there. We can wait for the IRS to catch up and process it, or we can now go back and maybe look at your years before tax returns.
Sure.
So, okay, Rob, you gave me your 13 and 14 tax returns. I just got notification back from the IRS that the 2014 tax returns have not been processed. So why don't you give me your 2012 tax returns, and I'll use your 2012 and 2013 tax returns to qualify you. Well, Robert, why didn't you ask me for the 2012s up front? Why are you asking for them now at the last minute? I didn't know I needed them up front. I didn't know that you waited to the last minute to file your tax returns, right? So these situations do happen, and people get frustrated because they think the deal is done. They think they're ready to go. And then we come back and ask for more documentation. And it's important that you understand as a home buyer that in most cases, the request for additional documentation is triggered by something else you gave us. So the more documentation you can give us up front, and the sooner we can find out what's going on, the sooner we can figure things out, the less problems we're going to have. You give us a bank statement. All of a sudden, there's a huge deposit on there, right? You're running along and you have $1,000 a month in your bank average, And then the day before the statement came out that you gave me, there's a $20,000 deposit. I'm going to have to ask you where that money came from. Because if you borrowed it, there's a problem. We have to know about that. You can't use it for your down payment. If someone else gave you that money because you're going to buy the house for them and this is some kind of straw buyer scam, we have to know about that too.
Yeah.
You know, all this is triggered by people who have tried to beat the system in the past. So the sooner you tell us, oh, well, that was a gift from my Aunt Sally. We're very close. She wants to help me buy my house. No problem. But we're going to need proof that it actually came from Aunt Sally. We're going to need proof that Aunt Sally had the $20,000 to give to you. We're going to need Aunt Sally to sign a gift letter saying that she is, in fact, your aunt, and she did, in fact, give you that money. Because guess what? People have tried to cheat the system in the past. Mm-hmm. They went out and they borrowed $20,000, knew they couldn't use that for their down payment, so then they tell us it's a gift. Oh, that's a gift. A gift from who? A gift from Aunt Sally? Okay, well, I need proof that Aunt Sally gave you the gift. Oh, it was cash. Okay. Well, then just give me proof that Aunt Sally took the $20,000 cash out of her bank account. Oh, Aunt Sally kept it in her mattress. Okay, so there's absolutely no paper trail at all that Aunt Sally gave you this money. We at that point have to assume that the money came from somewhere else.
Right.
You borrowed that money off a credit card. You took out a loan from a loan shark. Whatever it is, this is what we deal with. And so I want everyone to understand the documentation phase. But on the flip side, for some people, it's super easy. You know, if you've been on the same job for a couple of years and none of these gotchas pop up, then you can give me your documentation one time and I'll never come back to you for another document.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're talking about here today is kind of that worst case scenario. Because my hope is everyone listening picks up on one little thing and says, oh, I just got hit with child support. Let me make sure I tell my lender about that. Oh, my down payment's coming from my aunt and she keeps her money in a safe. That may be a problem. Let me talk about that now. You know, by knowing what these worst case scenarios are, because all mortgages are not this tough to document.
Right.
It's only the ones that have the gotcha that something goes wrong. I'd say maybe 5% of our mortgages have this kind of excessive documentation. 95% of people, it's clean. The two bank statements are perfect. Their name's right there. The bank name's right there. The account number's right there. The average balance is there. The money's been in their savings account for both months. It's no problem. They're W-2 at a job. They're 40 hours a week. Their tax returns are a 1040 easy. They've been filed with the IRS. Everything is perfect. You will have an easy time in the documentation stage.
Mm-hmm.
If you haven't filed tax returns, you file all kind of crazy business returns. You know, you have income that varies all over the place. You have weird large deposits where you move money from account to account to account. All this is going to cause problems during the documentation stage. So something to think about as you do look to buying a house.
As Robert said, for most people, the process is nearly seamless. But in some cases, things in your life get complicated and communication has got to be the key with the mortgage company. Just remember, nobody's picking on you. They're not trying to make things difficult. They are simply documents that by law must be reviewed to get that mortgage. Let's talk about affordability, Robert. You know, it happens so often. A couple will fall in love with the house and later they'll have a conversation and they'll say, well, we know the payment's a stretch, but we can trim a thing or two. We can make that payment. Well, the husband may verbally volunteer to cut back on golf or tickets to the big game. And the wife may say, okay, I'll cut down on pedicures. But you know what? So often these sacrifices are never made. And Robert, people become a prisoner of the house payment.
Yeah, we try to have a lot of conversations about budgeting. Just because you can qualify for it doesn't mean that's what we're going to put on your qualification letter. Because again, that's exactly what happens. You know, it's the first thing we're going to talk about is what are you comfortable with? You know, before we talk about what we think you qualify for, how much of a house payment do you think you'd be comfortable with? Oh, well, Robert, I think we're comfortable with $1,200 or $1,400. Well, good. You may qualify for $1,800 or $2,000, but let's start with what you're comfortable with. Because again, we don't know your habits. You know, how often do you eat out? Do you pay for daycare? You know, so when you're being qualified for a mortgage, we only look at your debt, you know, because you can't stop that. The idea is anything you could turn off. You know, if your wife loses her job or if the husband loses his job, then you could pull the kid out of daycare and take care of him yourself. You could cut off the cable. You know, you can quit eating out. And so we don't factor those into qualification because we know if you cut your lifestyle back to the basics, you can make the payment. But is that what you want in life?
Yeah.
Do you want to be in a situation, you know, where all your income is going into your house and you can't afford to do the things you like to do? So I always like to start the conversation with, you know, with how much can you afford? And a lot of home builders hate this. You know, they want their preferred mortgage company to tweak you up as high as you can because they want to sell you every option and everything they can.
Sure.
You know, we really like to understand with our client what's going to make you comfortable And then again, watch out for the gotchas like higher taxes, higher, because if you tell me you want $1,200 payment and all of a sudden the taxes are $300 a month instead of $200 a month, well, guess what? Your payment's going up by $100.
Yep.
And even though you still qualify for it, and this can be a trap because, so if you only qualify for $1,200 a month and you fall in love with a house that's $13, you come back to me, we have to say no. Because you just don't qualify.
Yeah.
But if you do qualify for the more money, but you were just trying to stay conservative, now you have a harder time trying to convince your family and everybody else. Well, honey, the mortgage company will give us the loan for $1,300 a month. Why aren't you comfortable with it? Well, dear, I think we should really stick around $1,200. Well, we can get approved for $1,300 though, and the house we love is $1,300. And we see a lot of people fall into this trap, and they end up buying more house than they're comfortable with. They can afford it, but now they have to make lifestyle changes. And not everyone's willing to make those lifestyle changes, which is how people can get in trouble with owning a home.
Back to basics, Robert. When we go to secure a loan, the word lock comes up, and many people are totally familiar with the process, but if they make the wrong choice, it can cost them, right? The first thing they hear from the loan company is, oh, you should never lock.
So they tell you this, and they convince you to float. And as soon as you agree to float, you've now lost all your power. Because again, they quote you this great rate up front. They convince you to float, right? Rob, put yourself in this situation.
Right.
You're a home buyer. You listen to rule number one. You shop around. You're doing good. But then you let the mortgage guy convince you to float. Okay. So now 30 days go by and it's time to go to closing on your new home. And they say, okay, Rob, we can't float anymore. It's time to go to closing. You have to lock the rate in before you can go to closing. And you know what? My sister's brother's best friend was wrong.
Oh.
Rates did not get better. And in fact, they're much, much worse. And I'm now going to give you a 9% interest rate. What are you going
to
do?
And you're going to ask me to bring more money to close.
What are you going
to
do, Rob? I mean, are
I've
you going to
stay with you? You got me handcuffed.
Are you going to walk away from the dream home? Are you going to walk away from the home that you're in love with, that your wife's in love with, that you've showed the kids and you put the pictures on Facebook and you've enrolled the kids in school and everything? Or are you going to take the ridiculous 9% rate? Now, that's obviously a very outlandish example. No one's going to raise the rate that much. They could. What would you do? I mean, what if they raised your rate to 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 20? If it's the day before closing, what are you going to do?
You're stuck.
You're stuck. You have two choices. Take the higher rate or walk away from the house. And the industry knows that most people will take the higher rate.
And if you walk away,
because they're emotionally attached.
If I walk away, there's also penalties attached, right? I'm going to lose my escrow or I'm going to lose
something. Absolutely. You can even get sued by the seller at that point because, see, the thing is you have financing in place. Now, some real estate contracts are written that your financing has to be below a certain rate or else it doesn't qualify. But even that expires with the finance contingency. So it's just a bad situation. So the way to protect yourself from this is simple. Make sure you get the rate lock. Lock the rate in up front. Do not let them convince you to play the float game. Mm-hmm. The only person who benefits from you playing the float game is the mortgage company, okay? Because remember, it costs us money to lock your rate in, right? So by locking your rate in up front, we take more risk in the market because I have to lock your rate in, and then if the inspection comes back bad or the appraisal comes in lower and these things, I can potentially have losses in the market. And we have really complex formulas I wrote for our hedging software that I wrote that does all this here at RP Funding, and I think we do it better than most people. So we don't take as much risk, but some lenders have a really high risk, especially when you're dealing with a mortgage broker, because the mortgage broker, the lender doesn't even know if they're actually going to get the loan. So the mortgage broker has to lock the loan with the lender, and then the lender doesn't even know if the mortgage broker really has a file. They've never even met you. And so there's all this cost built into rates around locking. So what mortgage guys figured out is they can make more money if they convince you to float to the end. And then on top of that, they can bait and switch you because they can quote you a really low rate today. Oh, yeah, Rob, we've got the best rate in the country today. Let me give you a 2.2% interest rate. And you say, okay, great, let me lock that in. Well, no, Rob, we shouldn't lock it in. We shouldn't lock that in. We want to let that float. Right? Don't ever float. Right? I force every customer to lock in. That's my personal belief. That is one thing I am so passionate about, right? And it's just such a core part of my beliefs that you do not gamble with this. You do not float your rate. Nothing good can come for the consumer out of floating the rate. And that's why we force everyone to lock in. Even if it costs me business, even if it costs me a customer, I'm going to force you to do what I know is best for you, which is lock your rate in on your mortgage upfront at initial time of application. Because what happens a lot of times is you say, well,
Well, if I float and the market gets better, I would get a lower rate. In theory, yes. But what most mortgage companies do is they float you, and if the market gets better, they don't tell you about it, and they just keep the extra money.
Yeah.
All right, this happens every day. When I was in wholesale, so before RP funding, I actually bought loans from mortgage brokers. It's a part of what we did.
Sure.
We bought loans from mortgage brokers. We bought loans from other correspondent lenders. So we would see how they did business and how they took advantage of their clients and what they did. And this whole floating thing, the customer almost never got the benefit of it. They would always leave the customer at the same rate, and they would pocket the difference if the market got better. If the market got worse, then they would jack the customer up higher. If the market stayed the same, they would usually jack the customer up and lie to them and tell them the market got worse. So the simple way to avoid all this, and this is a key part of shopping for a mortgage, rule number one is shop around. And then a sub rule of that is if you are shopping for a mortgage, make sure you can get a written rate lock commitment up front. It's the only way to protect yourself from a bait and switch or from a bad situation down the road is to have that written rate lock agreement up front. And so if a company has some kind of crazy rule, like you can't lock the rate until the third Thursday of every leap year, or you can't lock the rate until the appraisal comes back, or you can't lock the rate until the senior vice president gets back from Hawaii and reviews your file personally. I mean, I don't know what kind of crazy stuff they come up with, but you want a company that can lock your rate in, I would say, within 24 hours of the initial conversation. You do not want to let a lot of time get by, because see what happens is if I tried to resell you a 9% rate 24 hours later, you've got plenty of time to go somewhere else.
Oh, sure.
So you still have the power as the consumer. But once you let 2-3 weeks go by and you haven't locked that rate in, you've given all your power back to the mortgage company and you are now at their mercy. And when you're at their mercy, they're going to make more money on you because it is what they do. They are like vampires.
This all ties in directly with the Saving Thousands rule number 11. Don't gamble with the essentials. You know, retirement accounts, savings accounts, interest rate locks. These essentials should be safeguarded so you don't get taken. Again, your copy of the Saving Thousands rules is at savingthousands.com. That's savingthousands.com. I've mentioned a few of the Saving Thousands rules so far on the show, and you know, Robert, these are effective but easy to follow guidelines that can really change people's financial lives.
Let's recap the rules, Rob. We've talked about these. Rule number one, always shop around. All purchases, banks, ATM fees, credit cards, mortgages, life insurance, everything. Car insurance. I could go on and on. Rule number one here on Saving Thousands is always shop around. Rule number two is know your numbers. All right, know your numbers. This is your credit score. We've talked a lot about that this week, how to dispute items, the balances on your cards, the interest rates on your cards, car loans, mortgages, everything. So you've got to know your numbers. All right, rule number three is the three-day rule. This is the pledge that all of us financial ninjas here on the Saving Thousands Radio Network, before we take on any type of major purchase or before we apply for any type of credit or take out any type of new loan, we are going to think about it for 3 days. All right, this used to be a rule that was used in dating and one that I inaccurately tried to use on my now wife.
Wow.
And but it's much better when applied to finance, not so good when applied to romance. So 3-day rule. We're going to wait 3 days before we make any decisions on a large purchase. And it really does empower you. When you're sitting there with that pushy sales guy and he's like, you know, when he leans in and he offers you the pen, right? You know, like these 1960s closing techniques, like, oh, would you like to use my pen or your pen? I don't need a pen at all. Thank you. I'm going to wait 3 days before I make a decision. You know, well, what can we do to get you to commit today? You can't do anything to get me to commit today because I'm going to wait 3 days because I listen to Robert Palmer on the Saving Thousands Radio Network and I'm going to follow the 3-day rule. So it's a good way for you to push off that pushy sales guy. Mm-hmm. It's a good way to push off that clerk in line at the department store who's trying to sell you a high interest rate credit card. Would you like to sign up for your whatever card today to save 20%? I would love to, but I have to take that pamphlet, go home and read it, and wait 3 days and make a decision. And if I still think it's a good idea, I will come back here and buy more of your glop or whatever it is I'm buying, and I will get the discount then. So that's the 3-day rule. That's the first three rules we talk about a lot. So moving on, maybe some new territories from our listeners. Rule number four is we are not going to abuse credit, but we're not going to fear it either. All right. So
very important.
Don't abuse credit. This is big, you know, but don't fear it either. The solution is not to just have no credit. The solution is not to bury your head in the sand and be afraid of credit and think that you can get through life with nothing and no credit score. Because let me tell you, where maybe 10 or 15 years ago you could, we are moving more and more and more toward a society where the credit score is used in so many parts of your life, from insurance to any type of business financing. I mean, there's just so many ways that score is being used that you can't ignore it. And you know, we maybe had a chance as consumers to fight this trend. That ship has sailed. It is getting more and more mass appeal to businesses and to all aspects of our life. So we can't be afraid of credit. The other reason is there's ways you can take advantage of credit and you can make money. You can arbitrage. You can, you know, you can take advantage of that 6 months interest free and then invest your money in a mutual fund and make some cash. You can take advantage of that car deal where it's 6 months interest free and put your money to work somewhere else. You can take advantage of those airline miles. You know, I get a couple of nice vacations a year off of my American Express points. And if I was afraid of credit, see, I've got the money. I don't have to use credit. I could pay cash for everything. I could use a debit card for everything. That's another issue we've talked about is the risks of using a debt. I may have to make that a rule, Rob. That just
we need to put that
financial ninjas don't use debit cards. I think I may jump out there and be that bold with it. So all these things, you can't be afraid of credit, right? It doesn't work. And so what I'm going to do here on the show is I'm going to teach you how to use credit to your advantage. That's what we do. But you've got to have it. You can't. A life with zero debt, with zero credit, just doesn't work in today's society. Now, I'm not saying be a slave to debt. I'm not saying bury yourself. But, you know, there's some great tax benefits to having a mortgage. There's a lot of benefits to using credit cards and then just paying them off every month. If you pay them in full every month during the grace period, you haven't cost yourself any interest, but you're able to take advantage of the miles or the rebates, the protections, right? There's all these great things there. So that's rule number four. Don't abuse credit, but don't fear it either. Rule number five is if you know their tricks, they won't work, right? And so,
I love that.
So for this, you know, I really do believe, and I know from experience that big financial services companies absolutely use tricks to try to confuse us and get us to overspend, get us to not pay our bills on time. You know, we talked about the trick of trying to get consumers to go paperless. You know, they want you to give up getting paper statements and deliver them to you electronically because then they can hide all the disclosures. That's the trick. Because then you don't know how much money you could save by paying it off in 3 years instead of 20 years by only sending in an extra $10 a month. You know, these are the tricks. They want you to sign up for that credit card in line when you're not paying attention, when you're not asking questions like, what's the annual fee? What's the APR? They want you to float that mortgage rate. They want you to not lock in. They want to let you float around out there and flop around as a floater, you know, who has no control of their destiny and give them all the power back. That's one of the tricks. And as a consumer, if we know the tricks, they don't work anymore. They can't trick us if we know what they're trying to do. So rule number five, if you know their tricks, they don't work.
Again, you can access your copy of the 15 Saving Thousands Rules to Success by logging on to savingthousands.com. Now, you'll also find empowering articles on all areas of finance from adjustable rate mortgages to credit cards, mortgages, and refis. You'll also find past editions of this radio show and of Robert Palmer's very popular and very informative daily show, The Money Minute. Okay, Robert, let's get back to those rules.
Rule number six, you've got to spread your knowledge. You've got to educate your friends and family. You know, for so long, money and finance and credit scores was this taboo, and nobody wanted to talk about it. And I think the newer generation, the younger generation coming up is more open to talking about it. You know, that there's no shame there. Why are we afraid to talk about it? And I honestly believe that this fear, this taboo was created by big financial services companies, the financial services industry, because by keeping us from being willing to talk about it, the tricks will work more. They can confuse us more. We don't have the power of our core group and our support group and our friends and family knowing what's going on. You know, no one wants to tell their friends and family they have a bad credit score. But if you told them, then maybe they can help you fix it. You know, they can help you make better decisions. No one wants to talk about where they are financially, how much money they make, all these things in their lives. But if we talk about it, we can make better financial decisions. We can be a financial core group. You know, Rob, when I was a kid, my mom brought home her paycheck in cash and showed me this is the son. This is what I get every month. This stack of money right here. And I'm going to show you where it goes. And there's a lot of parents that are probably just appalled at that. Why, you would tell your kid how much money you make. You would show your child what your finances look like. one of the best things that she ever did for me. I mean, if you want to talk about an education and why do I understand so much about this? Well, being exposed to it at a young age and seeing the real world numbers and watching her take the pile of cash, which to me is however old I was, you know, 9, 10, seemed like all the money in the world. And then watching the pile for income tax and the pile for rent or for the mortgage and the pile for the credit cards and the pile for food and the pile for car insurance. And all of a sudden there was nothing left. And that huge pile of money that seemed like to a little kid a fortune was gone. Gone right there in 1 month, gone. And if we don't talk about it, if we don't spread our knowledge, if we don't share this with our friends, if we don't tell our friends about resources like this radio show, and we don't tell our friends about the things we learned and about the rules and to shop around and to wait 3 days and to know our numbers, we're doing them a huge disservice. And so we've got to stop this taboo. We've got to break through. We've got to be stronger consumers. We've got to take back the power. And rule number 6 is spread that knowledge. You know, share it with your friends and family. Don't be afraid to talk about this stuff. Rule number 7, this is a big one. So rule number 7 is if you own or run a business, be transparent with your customers.
Amen.
Right? So if I can reach, I think we have like 100, 120,000 listeners a week here on the Saving Thousands Radio Network. Mm-hmm. So if I can reach 100 or 120,000 people and get them to follow these rules, that's big. But if I can reach some business owners or some business managers, some people who have the power to take their business down a different path where they encourage their consumer to shop around, they encourage their consumer to rate through. I mean, rate through. Imagine if you went to that car dealership and they said, okay, sir, we know you want to buy this car. We want you to go home 3 days and think about it and make sure it's the right decision for you, right? I mean, some sales manager just jumped out of his window just hearing me say
that's
that.
Right.
But, you know, these are the types of things that if businesses buy into, then the other however many million people that don't listen to me can benefit as well. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, rule number 7 is about spreading. It's my way to spread this knowledge by encouraging business owners and business managers to run their business like I do in a way that puts consumers first and in a way that reinforces the rules and the principles we teach here on the Saving Thousands Radio Network. Rule number 9 is practice what you learn and always learn more. So this is one of yours, Rob. Rob Newton contributed this one. If you don't practice it, what's the point? I mean, if you're not going to do this stuff, if you're not going to shop around, if you're not going to know your numbers, if you're not going to wait 3 days, if you're not going to, you know, refuse to abuse credit, and if you're going to fear credit, and if you don't want to know their tricks, and if you do know them, you're still going to let them pull them on you, then what do you go flip over to classic rock or pop music or something? I mean, why are you wasting your time listening to me if you're not going to put this stuff into practice? So rule number 8 is practice what you learn, and then you've always got to learn more. I am a constant student. I can still learn, you know, and I think no matter how big my company is, no matter how much I do and how much I know, I can always learn more, and there's always someone I can learn from. And I'm always reading books, and I'm always listening to other shows, and I'm always trying to educate myself, and I think that's an important rule. So that's number 8, practice what you learn and always learn more. And then rule number 9 is share your successes. So this is different. So sharing the knowledge, right? Sharing the knowledge is about telling other people what's going on and sharing the resources and a way to learn. Sharing your successes is when you then go back and say, hey, you know what? I did some of this stuff and I actually saved some money. This is what sharing your successes rule number 9 is all about. Because when your friends and family and other listeners hear that this stuff does work, and that you did try it, and that you don't have to be a financial guru. You don't have to be the owner of a big company. You don't have to be a mortgage guy. You don't have to be a financial guy. You don't have to be a talk show host on the radio to do these things. Anybody can do them. And so you've got to share your successes, because that's what's going to help us spread this culture to other people. Mm-hmm. Because what really makes the whole Saving Thousands charter powerful is when enough consumers are following it that businesses have to change. And businesses have to react. And businesses have to stop the abusive practices that they've gotten so good at, right? Because we're done as consumers. We're not going to do it anymore. We're not going to put up with it. We're going to follow the rules. And we're going to only want to work with businesses who encourage people to follow the rules. And it's going to be this whole revolution. And so you've got to share your successes. Other people have to be aware and have to know that this is working for you, because that's going to be their motivation to do better and to be smarter and to stop being a financial zombie and to stop meandering around out there floating in a raft with no anchor and becoming a financial ninja and making good decisions.
You know, I've known people whose lives were a wreck because of overspending and missing payments. They really had no hope, and they just went from paycheck to paycheck, and they were constantly behind. Then they finally copied those 15 saving thousands rules to success and began to put the rules into motion. Now, before long, things began to clear up, and they actually took charge of their money. See, these guidelines aren't theory. They're proven ways to finally become empowered, and it can happen with you. Follow the saving thousands rules. Listener Beth writes in, I listen to the show every week, then I share what I've learned with my friends and family. Can you tell me what is escrow?
Escrow, that's a good question. You know, See, this is the little things that I forget about. You know, you do it for so long, you forget what some of the things that you know that the normal average person does not know.
Yeah.
So the whole idea behind escrow is that we're going to pay the taxes and insurance for you out of the mortgage payment. And so what happens is, Rob, obviously, you make your mortgage payment monthly,
mm-hmm.
right? But taxes, property taxes here in Florida are only due once a year, and that's in November. And then insurance is due usually once a year, and it's on the anniversary of when you got your policy.
All right.
So if we bought your home in March, then your insurance is due every year in March. And so a lot of people all of a sudden get hit with this bill, and it's like all of a sudden they owe $6,000 in taxes or $2,000 in insurance, and not everyone has budgeted accordingly and kept that money out. And so we decided in the mortgage industry it would be helpful if we collected 1/12 of the taxes every month and 1/12 of the insurance every month so that when the bill comes, we pay it instead of the homeowner. Now, some people don't like that, right? Some people want to waive escrow. They want to handle the account themselves. They want to, you know, try to collect interest on it and pay it themselves. And that's fine. The problem is we charge you a little bit higher rate for that because it increases mm-hmm. our risk
mm-hmm.
Because the chance of someone defaulting. And then also we as a lender don't get to make the interest on that money. You know, we have millions and millions of dollars of people's escrow money sitting in an account. And so there's a what we call an escrow waiver cost, right? And so it increases the cost mm-hmm. of your loan. Usually it's about an eighth of the interest rate. It's not a huge consideration. In some cases, you know, you can buy it out with a small, like a quarter or a half point of discount
right.
To get rid of that escrow waiver cost. But most people take the escrow account. You know, it's one of those things. It's convenient. We take care of it for you. We pay it. And then if you are putting less than 20% down on most loan programs, you have to have an escrow account. Because the idea is if you're putting limited money down, you don't have enough liquid cash laying around that you can handle the big hit for the escrow account, mm-hmm. For the escrows once a year to pay your own taxes and pay your own insurance. So I recommend people just let us handle it for them. It's cleaner. It's easier. You can budget monthly instead of worrying about it once a year.
Very good. Very good. Okay, now that we know that. Now, sometimes in calculating when you're going to get your home loan, you might have to put some money up in front, right? Because very, very seldom are you going to buy your home exactly on the anniversary of either the property taxes or the insurance.
Yeah, so the insurance, what happens when you're buying a new home, the insurance you're going to pay for 1 year at closing, and then we're going to collect a two-month cushion to put into your escrow account, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that cushion is there because taxes and insurance will change a little bit. Things happen, things go wrong. Now, with the taxes, you're absolutely right. Very rarely are you buying a home exactly in November to where we can collect the right amount of taxes. So what happens is we have to figure out how many months of taxes we're going to need. So let's say you buy your home in August, right? And so if you close in August, your first payment is not due. You skip September, right? Because you pay interest in arrears. So when you close in August,
mm-hmm.
and then interest will accrue the entire month of September, and then you'll make your first mortgage payment to us on October 1st. Right. So we'll have gotten 1 month from you. And then in November, we have to pay the taxes. So we're going to be 11 months short. So the idea is we have to collect all 11 months at the closing.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'll receive a tax proration credit back from the seller. So the title company will figure out and say, OK, well, the seller lived in the house through August. So they owe this many days worth of taxes and they give you a credit back for that. And then we put 11 months worth of taxes into your escrow account. And so, again, what it ends up being is about 3 months worth of. You have to put about 3 months in because the seller's putting the rest in. You're going to put about 3 months in, and then we're going to collect the rest as we go so that when November rolls around, we have enough money to pay your taxes, which is really what this is all about, making sure that your taxes get paid on time and that your insurance gets paid on time because we don't want anyone to have a home with no insurance on it and us having to force place insurance. So if you do not escrow Ooh. And you do not pay your insurance and your insurance gets canceled, we then have to force place an insurance policy on you as the servicer. And it's not a very friendly policy. It's not something you want to do. So we really want our customers to keep their insurance current, keep their taxes current, and the easiest way to do that is to let us handle it through the escrow account.
Thank you, Robert. That brings us to the end of the show, but there's more empowering information at the website I mentioned, savingthousands.com. And you can hear full versions of the Saving Thousands radio show by accessing Robert's exclusive station on iHeart. With all of this information and all of us working for you, we can all save thousands with Robert Palmer.